at least until I die. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know damn well I won't. Working for a living, work. Working for a living, work. Working for a living, living and a working. I'm taking what they're giving, cause I'm working for a living.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 41, No Reviews, Just Analysis. Up this week, two comics from May 7th, 2014. She-Hulk number 4 and Rat Queens number 6. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we welcome Allison Baker and Chris Roberson from Monkey Brain Comics. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so consider this your spoiler warning.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so listen at your own risk. We take no responsibility for anything you do as a result of this podcast. Make good choices, kids. This week's theme is right along those lines, in fact. Don't quit your day job. No, really, that's the theme. We're looking at two comics whose characters' jobs are an integral part of their identities in very different ways. I guess for most of us, that's true in real life, too. The question is, do we define our jobs or do our jobs define us?
Is this a Fight Club situation?
I don't think so. Although, we've been fighting for the last half an hour about music, so I'm all about that.
If it turns out you're just a figment in my head, or vice versa, that'll be quite a twist. Oh, spoilers too, if you haven't seen Fight Club. In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, answering life's deepest geeky questions, and celebrating what we love and what we snark about comics. This week, we ask for the obvious, the best examples of jobs in comics. Every week, you can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
The question this week is, what super or comic book character has the best real-life job? And I'm going to cheat and say Stan Lee. He's been in some comic books, along with some of his other friends like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, and their real-life jobs are creating some of our favorite stories. So drop the mic. I'm done.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, arguing with Aaron, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. Although right now, he's arguing via the show account, at Comics Therapy.
Which we have mutual access to.
We don't have mutual access to.
In theory, we do.
We may have at one point, but it is 100% you. Everybody knows that. Stop trying to make it otherwise.
60-40.
What's new this week, Aaron?
Lots of comics.
Yeah.
Buying, selling. I'm like a comics broker now.
This is the way you always are.
Not really. I'm really stepping it up this week.
Oh, okay. I know that my Facebook feed is overwhelmed with your postings.
Well, that is Facebook's fault.
Not really. You can shut those off.
No, I can't.
Really? I thought the whole point was that you discovered that you can and you sort of apologized and then you were going to fix it.
No, I cannot do anything about it. It's Facebook spamming everyone who's my friend who has anything to do with comics.
Mm. Thanks for ruining my Facebook experience.
All you use Facebook for is to write snarky things about things I post on there anyway.
Yep. It's awesome. I love it.
So if anything, I've enhanced it.
Oh, okay.
You're welcome.
Yes. Always.
What else is new this week?
Well, we're talking to Chris and Allison from Monkey Brain, and we should say, because it comes up in our conversation, that Chris's series, iZombie, was picked up officially by the CW today, so hooray!
Yes, congratulations, hooray.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So it'll be a nice thing to reflect back on if you guys are listening to the interview later. We talked to Chris and Allison just 2 days ago, and it was still not determined. So now it's official, and everybody go and congratulate them. That's super exciting news.
Yes.
What else?
Yeah, I don't know. My life, other than like buying new comics and reading comics, it's just kids and work.
Yep.
And dogs.
Yep. I get it. There's a lot of work in my life right now, too.
Well, tell me all the exciting things in your life, because you do all kinds of stuff. You go to parties.
I don't.
You go to movies.
Well, okay.
You go to sporting events continuously.
Both of those things. The sporting event is on hiatus right now, but I did go to a social engagement over the weekend. I did go also to see Amazing Spider-Man 2. Both of those things are true facts.
That must be nice.
You know what? I occasionally stack up my outside of the home experiences, and I get this like little burst of freedom, and then I go back to not doing anything. So simmer down.
That's fine. One of us can get out of the house.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. I saw Spider-Man. I have thoughts about it, and
well, I haven't, so I don't.
That's why we're not going to talk about it. It's okay. Mm-hmm. And
I like Spider-Man.
When are you going to see it, do you think?
I don't know.
It's not really something I don't know if it's going to be a movie thing. There you go. I don't know if it's.
Okay. Well, then I'll see it when it comes out on Blu-ray.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would like to see it in the theater, but I really have to pick and choose the movies I go to because it is burning a lot of, you know, freedom points, and there's only so many of those to spend per year.
Yes. Actually, I have to say that the strongest part of the movie is the visuals when he's moving throughout the city. So. Yeah. That is a thing that would definitely suffer from not being able to see it on the big screen. But then again, that's probably not worth it to go. It's really fucking long, too. It's with previews and everything, it's close to 3 hours.
Yeah, see, that's tough because that means it's 4 hours outside the house.
Right,
and
not worth it.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yep.
I already went to Captain America, so.
That was worth it. You made the right choice there.
I think so.
Yep.
I'm still paying for it, but you know. what else?
We are on hockey hiatus. Avi had a head injury this week, so.
But kids bounce back, right?
Yeah, this is kind of a serious thing.
He'll go to state school, big deal.
You know what I mean.
No, I know.
Head injuries, concussions, all that stuff for kids playing sports is like a big deal. I mean,
I've heard that happens occasionally in hockey.
It does happen occasionally in hockey, and you know what's kind of the worst thing to imagine is when it happens with a young kid and it's like not dealt with appropriately. So we've been trying to take it easy, and he's not allowed to have any physical contact or do any
from anyone. Like, you don't hug him or anything like
yes
that.
Well, that's the norm, but
right,
this
that's
is
the rule of the house. Yeah. Hugs are earned, they're not given.
That's right. No physical activity until he is symptom free for a couple of days. So
between you and me, that's probably a little bit of a relief, right?
For me?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not exactly my choice for how we achieved this break, obviously, but I'm not going to complain about not going to hockey 17 days a week.
Right. Yep. That's, silver lining.
Right. I mean, we're still watching hockey on television.
Oh, sure.
It's playoffs, dude.
You don't have to just sit that, whatever. That means this is for the Stanley Cup.
Good
right?
job.
Yes.
Yep.
I know facts. I just don't care.
I it's fine.
That should probably be on my tombstone.
I know facts. I just don't care.
Uh-huh.
Is that why I never win an argument with you? Because it doesn't matter if I'm right. You just don't care.
No, it's just I'm smarter than you.
Mm, there you go.
I mean, you got fancy degrees, but none of them are in argument.
No, I'm a terrible arguer. It's sort of a bummer. I have all of this knowledge to impart, and yet just the worst skills at sharing them with the universe.
Even after like 40 shows.
Yep.
No, maybe in 40 more.
But you can't get rid of me. I'm your token girl.
Yeah, but that's kind of a cool thing these days.
You told me the other day, you can't get rid of me. Nobody wants to listen to two dudes talk.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean I can't get another girl.
It's also, that's fair. It's also bullshit, because there's a lot of pairs of two dudes that, are kind of cool to listen to.
Yeah, well, I'm not one of those dudes that other people want to listen to.
There you go.
There we go.
I didn't even have to say it.
Well, I'll give you one every once in a while.
Thanks.
You want to talk about some comics, then?
That's
really what the people came for.
Sure. Is that what they come for? I thought they came to listen to us bicker about music.
No, that's what Twitter's for.
Did you actually minimize the window?
Yes.
I did not.
Well, that's why your portion of the show will be extra boring. Because you're distracted.
I'm always distracted, dear.
I know. You need to put your stuff away. Focus and pay attention.
Focus on what?
Eyes up front.
Okay.
You're a teacher. You know how this works.
I'm a theater teacher.
No, that's right. Just like, oh, I've got a PhD. It's like, music appreciation or something.
I don't have a PhD in music appreciation. That sounds like a bullshit degree.
Is it in art appreciation?
I don't have a PhD.
I thought you said you had degrees.
I have 2 master's degrees.
Everyone has master's degrees.
Yeah, but who is dumb enough to go back for a second one instead of going to get a PhD?
Well, there you go. let's move on.
Hey, comic therapist. Tom Zimmer here, or Victor Von Zoom, as my friends know me, with this week's comic book confession. The comic character with the best day job has to be, in my opinion, Steve Rogers. Steve Rogers has been both president or director of S.H.I.E.L.D., depending on your lifestyle choices. But the gig he's had that I'm most envious of is comic book illustrator. I mean, come on. That's awesome. Okay, guys, take it easy. Thanks.
Our first book this week is She-Hulk number 1, written by Charles Soule, with art by Javier Pulido, and colors by Munsta Vicente. Lettering is by Clayton Coles. She-Hulk is published by Marvel Comics.
I did
okay there, didn't I?
But you just said Clayton's name wrong.
No, I did it right. I thought it was Coles.
Is that just your accent? Do you have a little bit of a twang there?
Yeah, you know, it's my Oregon accent.
Northern California?
I don't think there's accents in Northern California.
The rest of the country probably thinks there is.
Yeah, maybe.
I didn't write a summary for this.
Really?
Nope.
Well, it's about She-Hulk. She's a lawyer. She's now an independent lawyer, and she's doing lawyering for super people.
That's pretty much it.
That's the series.
Her most recent client was Dr. Doom's son, who was trying to seek asylum to get away from his father. And that went well. She won.
From an execution standpoint, this is a very fun series.
Agreed.
From like the things brought up, especially in this latest issue, of the responsibilities of a lawyer and to their client,
mm-hmm.
and how that gets enhanced when you have enhanced abilities,
mm-hmm.
I find a lot of that interesting to think about.
Yes.
And also, it kind of goes to the whole superhero genre and sort of like the whole vigilante kind of idea of justice,
mm-hmm.
where superheroes and in the real life sense, like vigilantes, take the law into their own hands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's even more interesting when somebody who works within the law, like Daredevil or She-Hulk, basically forgets about that when it's no longer convenient.
Right. Well, like the example that Matt Murdock provides of going to rescue Black Cat from Rikers, just fucking busting her out, right?
Right.
That doesn't necessarily translate to actual right and wrong, law and lawlessness. I mean, that's your superhero twist, obviously.
Yeah, but it almost kind of makes me think like, well, for those two then, why work within the law at all? Because you're only going to work within it until it's not convenient anymore.
Well, okay, so first of all, Matt has a really important, he plays an important role of explaining a lot of this stuff to the reader when she goes to, like, Jen goes to San Francisco to, like, consult with him, right? Our other comic book lawyer example. Mm-hmm. And so then they can talk shop about lawyering and tell us about, I mean, basically answering your question right there. Like, why would you even work within the law? And I think that Matt's point about the separation of identities is the key. Like, that's why it was so devastating when he was disbarred, is that as a person, his identity as a lawyer is really important to him. It's important to his sense of self-worth, and it's important to his sense of place. And I think that Jen is in a similar way, which is why struggling to find a case and, like, deal with the ramifications of this particular case is causing her so much, like, internal turmoil.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's easy to just be a superhero. When you have a call in another direction, balancing those two things becomes more complex.
It doesn't even necessarily have to be just about the law, either. You know, this comes up in a lot of cases, and I guess it really applies to real life too. It's those living of separate lives,
mm-hmm.
and finding your identity within them, like how your job, you know, you identify who you are through your job, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, especially the more you work in it.
Yeah,
and I think as a in a professional capacity, especially because society kind of labels you and puts pressures on you for identification depending on what your career path is.
Sure. It starts with school. What's your major? And then what's your job? And then who do you work for? And
I'd say it even starts earlier. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah, truth.
You know, and that starts very early on. And so, but at the same time, like, if you look at statistics, like, people change careers multiple times throughout their lives.
Have you?
I guess. I mean,
Aaron,
I guess you...
What did you go to school for?
Well, that would be the career path change, but I never made it my job. I just did student teaching.
Right, but does it have anything to do with what you're doing now?
No, but at the same time, like, how did I pay for school? I was doing computers throughout school.
Okay.
So
Would you say that you shifted from one passion to another, or did you, like, sort of refine what it was that you were drawn to, or is it just that you're making use of a skill that you have?
I think it was more the making use of it. I mean, I always liked computers, and I always liked, you know, teaching and English lit. But, well, I will take that back. I didn't like teaching. I liked English lit. But I would say I liked it. I liked school and I liked learning those things. But when it came to applying it in a career capacity, mm-hmm. I didn't like what that meant.
Hmm. Okay.
And so I decided to focus a career in computers.
How much of that has to do with financial stability and, I guess, other kinds of stability? Job market and so on and so forth.
Sure. I probably would have... So if teaching paid the same as computers, mm-hmm. I probably would have continued with it.
Okay.
But when it came down to, at the end of student teaching, do I want to work for $32,000 a year, 70 hours a week, or do I want to work for $75,000 a year, you know, 40 to 50 hours a week? Hmm. And, you know, not be doing something that I wasn't finding very rewarding, or I didn't feel, you know, teaching high school at 25, I didn't feel that much older than the kids.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what it came down to. It was just immaturity, and I didn't feel that much separation-wise to where I could command, like, authority and, like, teach in a classroom. So, like, what about you? Have you changed careers? You haven't really.
I haven't really. I've changed focus within career. I mean, I guess, essentially, I still do theater, but I don't exclusively do theater. And there are other means to get to the type of work within theater that I do now that I could have gone down. I went to school to be like a scenic designer, production designer, art director, that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. I haven't done that exclusively in 12 years. I have done that on the side while I was teaching. But when I made the decision to go back to school the first time for education, that was sort of the signifier for me that I wasn't going to move to New York or move to Los Angeles and work full-time within the industry anymore. That was going to be like the start of a different path within the entertainment industry.
Yeah, well, that's fine. So it's still the same. It's still the same things you learned, but you're applying them differently.
It's not a complete departure. It's definitely very different, though. I mean, I couldn't do what I do now if I had just, you know, stopped school the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is that, like, different jobs have different requirements for credentials, and then it just gets all messy. But I think that that's where a lot of the identity comes from, is that the longer that you spend learning to do something for a job, the more that you've, like, literally given parts of your life away to it. And so it can be really difficult to switch gears and start doing something else, or to separate yourself and your personality and, like, everything about you from that when you spent 4 or 8 or 10 or 12 years learning how to make that be who you are. I mean, in a way, it's like getting out of a long relationship. You've given your life to this person, or you've given your life to this career, switching halfway through and saying, I don't know if this is right for me, or, like, maybe I need to go down this path, or maybe I want to pursue this person instead. Like, that's a really traumatic thing to give up if it's such an essential part of your identity.
Yeah, no, it's true. At the same time, it can be very liberating too.
Sure. Transition and change doesn't have to be negative. It's just, like, the process fucking sucks for a lot of us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's comfortable.
What are we talking about again?
Do we get off topic?
Surprise! No, but I think, like, just getting back to Jen's kind of quandary, the premise of this book is that, like, she was fired from her firm and she's on her own as a lawyer. Why? Like, why does she even have to be practicing law? Why isn't she just a superhero? And I think that that dichotomy is what makes her more interesting than just being another female superhero. Like, she's right. also pursuing a professional career.
I can see that. And at the same time, like, people, I would say, especially when it comes to comic book characters, but comic book characters in a lot of ways are analogs to things in real life. Mm-hmm. She needs to be she needs to be something, you know, whether it's a lawyer, private eye, you know, whatever it is. It's like, you know, who are we? And who the answer is, oh, I'm this.
What do you mean she needs to be something?
So she knows how to be a lawyer.
Right.
She needs to investigate. And, you know, in terms of comic books, we don't need another private investigator or detective or something like that.
Right.
You know, working within the law has a niche need.
So wait, you're saying that, like, she needs to, just getting back to this sense of, like, self-identity, like, mm-hmm. she needs to feel useful in that regard. Is that
what
you're saying?
That's how she knows how to feel useful. Yes.
Yeah. So, I agree.
Which is true for everyone. And that's what I kind of like about superhero comics is that I would say more for DC books than it is for Marvel, but it still kind of applies across the board that they fit these sort of, you know, these, whatever, you know, they are the examples of different things in our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, the detective, the perfect person, the lawyer, whatever it is, you know.
Hmm. But I haven't thought about Marvel books in those terms. But
you're right. I don't think that is the Marvel way. It's so much as, like, how DC started with mm-hmm. very, you know, black and white sort of examples right. of this guy is this guy. But it's true for Marvel books, just in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, they're analogs for different things. Mm-hmm. So,
but you also have to think very pragmatically here that, like, how else do you make this book succeed? Like, what's the hook for a solo book about She-Hulk?
Sure.
I think the hook is that we're not really seeing her being a superhero very often. She's not a regular lawyer. She's obviously a superhero lawyer. But mm-hmm. that, like, role has shifted very much in the way that the story is being presented. And that's the hook. That's why we care about her, is that it's not just another Daredevil book. And it's right. not just another, like, I don't know, She-Hulk's out on her own fighting bad guys kind of book. Mm-hmm. So it's a niche, and it's wee small. And I don't know how this book is selling. Do you have any idea?
No, I don't. The other aspect of it is is it that female empowerment kind of thing too?
Well, that's a little bit what I was trying to get to a couple of minutes ago. In terms of how she's not just another female superhero, because Captain Marvel has become the flagship female character in the Marvel universe. Mm-hmm. And varying opinions on the success of that book are kind of beside the point. She-Hulk is not in any sort of contention to replace Captain Marvel. But what can her career offer us as readers in terms of, like, a role model or any kind of, sure, empowerment or blah, blah, blah. The fact that she's a woman and she's a superhero. The fact that she is a woman and she's a lawyer. And look, she's doing both. Can she do both successfully? And can she balance that? I mean, shit, all she'd need was, like, a baby and we'd have the trifecta of female empowerment right there. Uh-huh. Please, please don't do that with this book. But I think that there is something to be said for a career superhero and a career professional and the blending of those two roles. That's an important little, like, bubble within the Marvel universe that I can't think of another really great example. When I was thinking about the answer to the prompt for this week about day jobs, there's not a lot of examples of women that came to mind, yet all of the books that we're talking about in terms of female characters. So that's kind of interesting. I haven't listened to the Nerd Confessions yet, but I'll be interested to see if there are any any women examples, because all of the ones that I could think of were men.
And I think the things too that come up in my mind are usually men. That's interesting too. Like, I didn't think of any women. We also didn't answer the question, but
yeah, I got yelled at last week because I didn't answer the question. So
me either. So are we doing that subconsciously to even get more, you know, ire towards us?
No. It was that I like started to answer it and then I didn't and sort of disdained it. I was just avoiding it this time because, like, I don't like to get in trouble. I'm afraid of authority.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, maybe next week.
Okay.
All right. You want to talk about her second book?
Yeah.
At one point, Karen Starr / Power Girl was the CEO of a software company, which in today's economy basically makes her the best parts of Superman and Batman combined. Thanks, Cass, at Giant Spatula.
Our second book is Rat Queens number 6, written by Curtis J. Weeb, with stunning art by Rock Upchurch. Lettering is by Ed Brisson. Rat Queens is published by Image Comics.
Yeah, I didn't write a synopsis for this one either.
It is a D&D style group of female mercenaries.
Sure.
Yeah. Mercenaries, adventurers. And their hijinks and exploits and battles within the surrounding areas of a town that they live in.
Good. That was really good.
Thank you. Mm. I'm really good at this.
Yeah. Yeah, you are.
I'm hella good at podcasting.
So, talk to me about this book.
You talked to me about this book. You hadn't read it until this week.
This is a true fact.
And I'm extra excited about that because it's sort of a all-in-one reading, and I wanted to get your first impressions.
Gosh, everybody loves this book.
And what do you think?
Okay. I don't not love it. No, okay. Let's go for I don't. I don't love it. There are things about it that I think are pretty excellent. I love banter. Everybody knows I love banter. I think it's really interesting that we have a cast of 4 women who are essentially are men who happen to be female.
Yes. Okay, good. You have the same feeling that I do. And that's a better way of explaining it. Like, that's what I've been kind of trying to articulate. And I think that works very well for me.
So I don't dislike that. There are many examples of characters that you could use that same description for. It is striking when you happen to have a cast of 4 and you can say that about all 4 of them. But, you know, it's probably a product of both the genre and the I don't know. I'm about to say things that are going to get me in trouble, but I happen to think that it's probably a product of the fact that it's written by a man. Maybe. Mm-hmm. God, I'm going to get nailed for that.
No, you don't have to. Well, or we can both because, and can we say before people start writing angry letters or tweets at us, like, I want to discuss this because it's not a bad book.
No.
I like reading it. I like that. I like and kind of am a little disappointed about how embraced it is by women, though. Is that weird? Like, it feels weird for me to feel that way because it's not really my place.
I'm not going to ever use the word disappointed because any time a book is embraced by readers, and especially a new contingent of readers, that's fucking fantastic. Disappointed is not the word that I'm looking for. It's also only 6 issues in, and we've just concluded the first arc, and we really don't know enough about these characters yet. Okay. So I am looking forward to what's going to happen. But right now, I'm feeling like there's not a lot of tension. Like, the stakes are high, but then they're immediately not high. When there are injuries, they're immediately healed. When things are dire, they're immediately not dire. There are some pretty epic battles, but, like, everybody wins. It's fine. So there's not some storytelling tension that would help us get to know the characters better. But right now, each of these 4 women are, like, strong and proactive and at the top of their game, like, physically. They work together well as a team. Why are those what is it about that that makes me feel like they are more male traits? That's the conversation that I'm interested in having. Like, what's missing to make it feel more, and God, fucking punch me for saying this, but to make it feel more authentically female? What is it about them that isn't working?
That's a very good question that I don't know how to answer, and I don't think I can ever answer.
Yeah, maybe you're not the right person to answer that, but I'm not sure that I am either.
I feel the same way, but at the same time, it's like we're trying to have that discussion, it's like, well, who am I to even discuss it? Because it's not really my discussion to have, you know?
I guess you can...
And I also think from like a... It's an interesting thing to talk about from a gender and sexuality mm-hmm. kind of aspect, you know, because is that feeling of it's, you know, more like female characters acting like men because we have these expectations of gender stereotypes.
Absolutely. It's a very troubling thing to even posit that we would be somehow defining the way that women should act and the way that men should act. And then when you mess around with the lines between the two, how is that not just subscribing to gender stereotypes? So like I have a hard time with it.
Isn't it kind of nice though that this book that is essentially on its surface a fun adventuring, you know, party kind of raunchy, you know, comic mm-hmm. has a lot of discussion potential too?
Yes. I just don't know the answers to any of the discussion questions. And that's one of the things that frustrates me because I, like at the end of these six issues, I enjoyed it. But I was left feeling sort of empty because of the, I don't know how to put it. Okay. Since we're talking about stereotypes, like let's just embrace it. One of the things that I want to see more is like dealing with the feelings that would come up with a group of women working together in a like high stress, high trauma environment. When you almost die and then you're like magicked back to life, is there not some kind of like process of dealing with that? They're like sort of skimming the surface of grief and of stress and I don't know, relationships between, I mean, there's like a ton of sex and drugs and rock and roll happening here, but without any big consequences for that behavior. And it's difficult for me to suspend my entire disbelief that all of the people involved, people I'm using broadly, whether they happen to be human or not human, they are obviously not all human. We've got a dwarf and an elf and like the little hobbity girl, whatever. There's an emotional immaturity that, bear with me, I tend to associate more with men in those kinds of roles than women.
Oh, snap. No, you didn't.
I did. I went there. It's the disconnect. It's the like shutting down of emotion in order to function, which is stereotypically, God, there's going to be so many caveats with this conversation. It's going to get both of us in serious trouble. But that is stereotypically a male trait.
Sure. I mean, can we say with this conversation, I think we're trying to tease out these ideas and like, I don't have any concrete feelings one way or the other. I have general feelings that is why I wanted to discuss this book.
Right.
About the same stuff. I feel the same way. And I think it's interesting to try to figure out why we feel that way. That is it something lacking with the book and its writing? Or is it something lacking with us and our, I guess our sense and evolution, you know, in terms of how we can identify people outside of stereotypical gender roles.
There's such a presence in comics right now, at least aspects of the comics community, to talk about these issues that I think the discussion can't possibly be a bad thing. I mean, unless you're just being a jerk about it. So discussing how gender roles in comics make us feel and how we don't necessarily have the answers to them and how we're individually kind of struggling with our response to various characters, like that's good, right? Mm-hmm. It has to be good because at least the conversation is happening.
Yeah, and I would go back even to say where like disappointment in how women have embraced this. Maybe, I mean, that's not correct.
No, it's not. I'm going to bristle at that particular word because...
That's fine. It's a poor choice of it's a poor choice of words, but I don't want to be vilified for any like the words we're using here too.
Okay.
I just want to talk about it because it's like if we're saying that this is, say we make the assumption that this book is really female characters written as men, and then if women embrace these characters as their own, what does that say about women? And like maybe it doesn't say anything bad, but it doesn't also say that everyone wants to be a man. It's just maybe some of the stereotypical attributes that men are given are really everyone's.
Sure.
You know?
And maybe we're a little bit tired of always reading damsel in distress stories or like yet another book where the only predominant role that, female character has is to be the catalyst for action by men. So yeah. When you have a reversal of that, of a sort, I mean, it's not entirely, we still have women in that traditional role in this book, mm-hmm. right? Like we still have women as victims.
And we have men as victims.
I guess right at the end of this one, sure.
Yeah. So if anything, it kind of, if you're thinking of this in an intellectual kind of way, which I don't know but I don't know if the book actually calls for that.
No.
It's just happens to be the kind of, you know, nerds we are.
Sorry, everyone.
Then there's a lot to mine here. Otherwise, you can just read it as a bunch of fun, loving, fighting, drinking, effing, you know, adventurers doing what they do.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy it
on cosplay that, as and
on that level, absolutely, totally enjoy it. I think that, as always, what gets me into trouble when I read anything or watch anything is if I overthink it or, you know, life anything. The minute I start overthinking about it, and that's on me. That's not always on the media. In fact, mm-hmm. a lot of times it's not. But my initial response to reading all six issues of these in one sitting was that there wasn't enough of an emotional rounding out of the four characters, the four like women, given the circumstances of their lives, both on and off the, you know, lack of a better word, battlefield.
I think that's a fair criticism.
I don't even know if it's criticism. It may not even be a valid observation. It may be entirely a product of my projection. And Man.
Look, it's not a review, it's just analysis.
No, it's not even analysis at this point. Like, I've also gotten nailed recently for being really wishy-washy, and that's cool. I embrace that. That's sort of where I'm at in my life right now. And and it's possible that as the series continues, I will, like, readjust and recategorize how I feel about it. Like I said, we don't know them well enough. There's a lot of potential for, like, really getting into more of their pasts and like how they deal with that kind of stuff moving forward and how they deal with the relationship stuff and like whatevs. But right now, just to go back to like Captain Marvel or to She-Hulk as examples of, I know they're superheroes, but the Rat Queens have like superpower-esque-ness to them.
Sure, yeah.
There's something about the juxtaposition of strength and vulnerability that I find appealing in female characters because I can relate to that. And so I hope that there is an opportunity to explore more of the second half of that within Rat Queens, to explore the emotional vulnerability side also. That's all.
I think that's good. And then I think that's good that you are parsing that out because it doesn't matter for me to think that.
What do you mean?
Well, because it's not my identity that, you know, that we're trying to kind of understand.
Are we trying to understand mine?
We're trying to understand female identity.
Oh, man. Let me know how that works out.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's done yet.
Yeah. Yeah, but, like, I also, like, I understand how I'm, like, saying one thing and then I'm switching gears and saying another thing and, like, I get that.
But that's what it is. It's not black and white. And just like just like gender identification or gender roles or anything like that. It's not black and white either.
Okay. So the ambivalence in and of itself can be embraced also, right?
Yeah. I think the ambivalence of gender norms is the norm.
Okay.
And I think as our society, you know, as a first world society has the time and resources to really kind of focus more on that, that's we're seeing that more. You know, when it comes to
human rights
and human equality. You know, this is a societal thing too.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. We solved it.
Yikes. I don't I'm left feeling like more conflicted about this and like way more aware of my personal coloring of the read of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I feel like my job is done. Any show where I can point out your hypocrisy is a win in my column.
Right. That's what it is, though, right?
Maybe, but we all, I mean, how do we function in life without assumptions and stereotypes? We have to.
True. And I guess as long as you're open to adjusting them when you are exposed to new information, maybe, like, that's sure. The secret is that
absolutely
that's the difference between being a hypocrite instead of just being an asshole.
Yes, the difference between bigotry and I don't know, the, you know, functioning within society is the ability to change.
Like, I struggle a lot with assumptions. I struggle a lot with like balancing my interest in acquiring more information and forming an opinion and then doing that prematurely and presenting that opinion publicly, and then fuck, now I have the whole story, or what I think is the whole story, and so I have to readjust my opinion. Gender roles in comics is like a growing topic of interest for me specifically, but then is like a very public conversation right now. So
So I think it's wonderful that you feel conflicted, you self-evaluate, you recognize your assumptions and are willing to adjust and work on your reaction to those.
Right, because reaction does not equal response.
Yeah, and the strength in somebody's intelligence and somebody's personality is not in what you maybe first react to, it's the ability then to change your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what takes courage.
Did you just turn that into a compliment?
I mean, in general, yeah. I didn't use names.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah. See, we solved it.
Awesome.
Well, you want to talk to a couple cool people?
Yes. We're going to talk to Chris and Allison from Monkey Brain, and everything's going to be excellent.
And everyone be excellent to each other.
Aw. That was a pretty good transition.
Thanks. Well,
see,
yeah.
Change isn't hard.
Yeah, don't get used to it.
Hi, Comics Therapy. It's Aaron Wagner from Lincoln, Nebraska, calling in. My answer would be Jack Knight, Starman, Slurp Store, and Cake Store, whatever he did, because that seemed kind of cool for a real-life job. Otherwise, talk to you guys later. Have a good week.
This week on The Couch, we're speaking with Allison Baker and Chris Robertson, publishers of Monkey Brain Comics. Allison is a film and political media producer, and Chris is a prolific writer of both prose and comics. He's the co-creator of the Eisner-nominated comic series iZombie, currently in development for television by the CW, and he writes a great many other things, including Edison Rex, drawn by Dennis Culver, who we talked to back in episode 35. Allison handles the day-to-day operations of Monkey Brain, and her column, Allison Types, appears on comicbookresources.com. They're both awesome in vastly different yet compatible ways, which is probably why they're content to both live and work together. We're going to delve into much more deeply into all of this in a bit, obviously, but thanks for hanging out with us, guys.
Happy to be here.
Yay, us!
Did we cover a lot of things in that intro? Is there
you did. It was kind of awesome to listen to.
We sound impressive.
You do. You do.
I was like, I'm going to talk to those people.
Well, you know, we only have you guys, though, so I guess we'll have to make do.
Right.
Just settle for us.
So let's talk big picture for a second, and Monkey Brain Comics first. And then we'll get into the individual projects from both of you. So you're in your second full year as publishers of the Eisner-winning creator-owned digital comics. And congratulations on this year's nominations, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll take full credit for all of the people's nominations that happen to be associated with us.
You're the only ones here, so you get to take all the credit you want.
Yeah, we only accepted the files from them and transferred them over, but we, you know, I really think we should get the Eisner.
I did call my shot. I was like, High Crimes is going to be my Eisner nominee. Yeah. And I called that like last year.
And she already knows what next year's going to be, but she probably shouldn't say.
I probably shouldn't.
Save that for Vegas. You got to use a proxy, put $1 million down on it.
Yeah, because Eisner's big money.
Yeah, Vegas is all about the Eisner.
Use some of that sweet, sweet Eisner money.
Yeah.
So you have print deals with IDW, Image, Dark Horse for some of the most successful titles. So let's kind of get into that. What are you most proud of looking back over the last couple of years? And what can you tell us about looking forward next couple of months from Monkey Brain?
I think I'm most proud of the fact that this weird, bizarre business model that I came up with in my head actually kind of worked and is continuing to work and continuing to basically spotlight creators that probably wouldn't have been spotlighted or even published to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases.
In most cases.
So, yeah.
In most cases.
Most, maybe, yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, despite the fact that, you know...
The work wouldn't have been published.
The work wouldn't have been published. Yeah. I mean, that's for sure.
Do you think that's changed since the... Maybe that was very true in the first year, and then the second year it's evolved? Or is that kind of the through line?
Well, I think that I have, by creating this model with the digital first and then, you know, basically print trade collections,
mm-hmm.
you know, the various publishers are kind of getting to see how things are performing and received in the community and into the marketplace, and are being able to, you know, kind of make decisions based on that more than just a pitch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a different process for them, which I think is an easier process for them. Hmm. So it makes it easier for them to, in the end, decide to take the print collection.
Well, I think they also are judging it based on the strength of the work, but, you know, it's rare that a creator would go off and make an entire, you know, 4 or 5 issue thing right. and then take it to a publisher to see if they want to publish it.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Unless they're a crazy person. They might self-publish it, but, like, that can be problematic because, you know, it's... I mean, at least traditional print self-publishing costs money.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Allison tried to incorporate in the model from the very beginning was a way to kind of amortize the risk and expense of making the thing so that like a small amount of money will trickle into the creators on a regular basis as they go. But then the advantage is that when it's done, the creators have a full thing that they can show to publishers
right.
and because they retain all the print rights. They can negotiate a very favorable deal for themselves.
And they also have a full thing that is part of a larger body of work that they associate with. I mean, just because it's not self-published. It's part of the
brand thing. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is extremely important, especially in the case of some of the younger or newer creators have kind of given a platform to that association, you know, guilt by association is really a powerful draw then when you're presenting your work externally.
And yeah, and I think that, you know, not only the work that they're doing for Monkey Brain, but, you know, I've noticed that there's a lot of editors from larger, a lot, I mean, obviously there's everybody's a larger house than we are.
Unless it's just one person.
Well, I don't know.
I guess it could be just like
is there
one,
a comic publisher that is just one person?
One dude, yeah.
Sure.
But, well, you know, the larger houses are kind of going after the creative talent and asking them to pitch for them. So,
or hiring them for work for hire gigs.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the advantage I see to it, like versus, say, Kickstarter, too, is you can have a fully done series without having to then deal with the printing, shipping, distribution, you know, as most of the Kickstarter models are.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the deliverable time is kind of at the pace of the creator, too.
And, you know, what Allison was saying is that the many of these books wouldn't have existed. I can tell you for an absolute fact that a number of the better regarded, more critically acclaimed titles had been rejected by many of the big publishers, and in some cases by the publisher that ended up publishing them.
Awesome.
But you know, by the same token, those creators then got book deals at those publishers without surrendering half of their media rights, which they would have done if the publishers had taken them at the outside.
Mm.
Certainly. So is there anything that you can tell us to look forward to in the next couple of months or throughout the rest of 2014? Are you guys going to drop a big announcement at San Diego again like you have been?
Those are a hassle.
You didn't even do San Diego last year.
Well, but I had to help, like, orchestrate getting all the stuff in the system.
Yeah, but, like...
That's what I'm talking about.
That was all on my head.
I'm talking about orchestrating the pre-press so it's all in the system on time.
Well, now that you have Eisner nominations, I mean, I'm sure you guys have plenty of money to hire interns and staff to kind of take care of all that now.
Yeah, totally. Right. Totally. Yeah. Well, once we get done installing the in-ground pool.
Sure.
Right. I mean, priorities.
Well, there is one really cool project that's going to be appearing in just a few weeks.
We've got some new stuff coming out, and then I think that we're going to probably do something for to celebrate the anniversary.
Okay.
But as you well know, I don't like to talk about things until they are happening. So
I know. It's okay. Well, it's just as long as we have a rough timeline that we can, you know, start paying attention at the beginning of July and in the next couple of weeks, it sounds like. And
I would say that, so beginning of June, first couple of weeks of June, we're going to start republishing a really critically acclaimed creator-owned indie book by a creative team that have gone on to do, like, really big things, more high-profile things.
There's no point in talking about it.
Doesn't matter. It's going to happen. It's coming out. You'll hear about it in a couple of weeks.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That's a shift, and that's not even something I really considered, you know, that reprinting of material. You see IDW doing that with certain series, kind of these remastering, but it seems like digital is a great platform for that kind of thing too, where a series that maybe got critical acclaim but didn't get wide distribution or have wide accessibility, really limited print runs now that are just kind of lost to, you know, eternity. Because nobody will ever get access to it.
It's something that we have been pursuing since the very beginning. Some of the first people we talked to were people who we were like sought out the rights to some of their older stuff, including one of the person who did the book that was about to happen.
Yeah, and we, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff out of print that we were trying to get back in, you know, to be available, basically.
Right.
Like, well, so we started with last year with Heartbreakers.
Yeah.
With Anna Bennett and Paul Guy.
Oh, right. Right.
It got a little bit sidetracked by real life and stuff, but it's going to come back on the schedule soon. It would be on the schedule sooner, but I inadvertently deleted the wrong folder on FTP and wiped out.
That's real life, man. That's it. That's your two people doing this. Wow. Oh, man.
Well, there was no one to blame but myself.
Right.
Yeah. but yeah, I think, you know, I would love to do more of that. There's so many fantastic books. You know, comics has a relatively long institutional memory for the mainstream kind of stuff. But the independent stuff are often things that people discover kind of later in their reading careers. You know, like, you know, they're a big DC person or they're a Marvel person or an Image person now, I guess, the thing. But maybe, like, if you were reading comics at a certain time, but you weren't paying attention to other kinds of comics, you could completely have missed something that's now completely gone off the radar.
Or like, for me, and especially pre-internet, where you could discover these things, you just, a lot of places, like, my store growing up didn't get much indie titles. Like, you know, Cerebus might have been, like, the biggest thing we got, and the rest was Marvel and DC. We just didn't get any of the other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, now there's the opportunity to kind of rediscover that. But say somebody, I mean, I fall into this all the time. I find series that, oh, I want to read this. It's been out of print forever. Oh, each of the issues I can find on eBay for, you know, $25 or something. It's like, you know, the barrier to entry is impossible. So digital seems like the best, a wonderful way to kind of resurrect a lot of that stuff.
Agree.
Yeah, it wasn't really a question, was it? I guess we're just preaching to the choir.
I think that Aaron's giving you a thumbs up on that one.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Glad to hear.
We'd like to see more of it. It just is that, you know, that's something that, you know, when we first started out, we really kind of wanted to bring some stuff back. But so, as you know, the more we can do of that, the more we want.
There's lots of complications, though, because we are such a effectively no budget operation. I mean, Monkey Brain does not expend any capital, except for, you know, the work hours, the man hours in doing it, the human hours.
Yeah.
And a lot of that older stuff that we went after doesn't exist in a digital form. Mm-hmm. And so it was a question of, like, scanning this stuff in. And somebody's got to do that, and that takes time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do it. Forget that noise. so, yeah.
Well, so as a digital publisher, you have to respond to how frequently the model is changing. I mean, you have the flexibility. It's an opportunity there to be separate from the traditional print distribution model, but you still have to, as a two-person operation, as you just mentioned, you have to incorporate those changes yourself and respond really quickly and appropriately. How do you do that? Do you feel like you've been able to stay on top of things and look ahead and anticipate changes and needs within the market?
I think so. You know, I think that, you know, Chris and I have always been interested in the business of comics. I think more so than a lot of people are. Mm-hmm. So we're always talking to people about what's going on and what's going on at this company and how things are changing. And, you know, so it's, you know, it's something that we are interested in regardless of whether or not we were running Monkey Brain.
Yeah.
I think that if you're going to be in a business, you should be knowledgeable about what everybody else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
To look and see, you know, to look for new ideas. You know, I'm not above looking at an idea and saying, wow, that's a great idea.
Right.
How do I incorporate that into what I'm doing?
Or asking, why the hell are they doing
or
that?
Or why are they doing that? Like, what's the rationale? Like, you know, exactly. So yeah. It's like, you know, can I figure out the rationale behind this? Because right now it looks like to me that that's the stupidest idea in the universe.
And sometimes it just is.
Sometimes it's just a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the older I get, the more my brain is atrophying, and the harder it is to keep up with how quickly technology changes and how you promote, you know, a business, a brand, etc., shifts very quickly. And in terms of digital comics or any kind of comics at all, keeping kind of on top of how to keep your brand relevant seems it seems like a daunting task to me. And not that I'm saying, you know, like how are you going to do it or anything like that. I mean, you definitely seem on top of it, but that's the kind of thing that would seem to expend a lot of man hours. You know, just the PR aspects of running a publishing company, digital or print.
Well, clearly, goofy press releases are the future.
It's true. They are entertaining, but I just said I'm an old fuddy duddy too, so I don't know if I'm the target audience.
Yeah, so, you know, I do.
I think you need to start incorporating more like Loki GIFs. I think they're pretty popular in Tumblr.
Oh, okay. I'll look at that. I'll look into that.
Just write that down.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's you know, we kind of built all this just completely based off of social media.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, established relationships we've had with certain members of the press. But a lot of times, you know, I'll do what I do and I kind of let the creators do what they want to do. I don't really put any kind of restrictions on them because in the end, it's their book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at this point, a lot of times we'll get press that I don't place.
And then sometimes we don't even know about until it happens.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Like, you know, Oliver Salva, who is, you know, will always be my new best friend at the AV Club, did a review of Dave number 4 on this huge write-up.
Right.
You know, completely glowing review of the book, but not just the book, but of the company. And, I mean, nobody does a spotlight review on issue number 4 of anything.
Of a 5-issue series.
Yeah, of a 5-issue series.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Nobody does that for any company. So when that came out a couple of weeks ago, I was like, wow, that was kind of cool.
But that definitely, not that the review is skewed or anything like that. I read that review and I thought it was great. I see that review stemming out of that social media contact.
Yeah.
You know, and that is that kind of that power of, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, et cetera, like that, in, that accessibility of connection.
Well, and I also think that, like, you know, I've been a big proponent and believer in the fact that, you know, business is built on relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to maintain good relationships with as many people as I possibly can. And when Oliver first kind of noticed us and started doing reviews of our stuff, I immediately was like, let me put you, he was started reviewing stuff without being on the press list. And I put him on the list. And every time he does something, I always write him a note and thank him. Because I think that it's important that we continue to have a positive relationship with one another.
That kind of leads me to a question about those relationships, you know, between the publishers, the print publishers, the creators, etc. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, especially now that your second year in business you've received a lot more attention. You know, now there's a spotlight on you. I think the demystification of how that works between the creators, you guys, and then the print publishers, mm-hmm. we kind of touched on that, but I think it would help people to kind of understand how that gels out for a lot of these books, like, you know, say, Bandette or something like that.
Well, it's the same for all of them, and I can break it down for you really easily. Monkey Brain licenses wholly creator-owned works. We license the print, the digital rights only for a period of 5 years with the option to renew at the end of that 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the creators retain all of the rights.
And so then they're free to shop to print publishers.
Do they actually then go out and address the publishers directly, or is that something that you can assist with?
You know, we know people at just about all the publishers. And of course, you know, now that a lot of the books have landed different places, you know, we have more contacts. And so if a creative team wants to open a discussion with one of the publishers, we usually know who to put them in touch with.
And if they come to us and ask for help, we're more than happy to help them kind of navigate that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's not something we don't have a piece of it, and so we are not in those. So if any,
we have no financial stake in any of it.
Yeah, or yeah. Rights.
I think that's important for people to understand, and I think that that's what a lot of casual readers don't get.
Well, you know, the different publishers are treated in different ways. I mean, you know, some have basically taken those collections and just kind of integrated more into their own kind of library. So you from the outset. If you didn't know that it had previously appeared as a digital title through Monkey Brain or elsewhere, you would not know. Like, this is just the book and it's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
IDW, for their part, really believes in Monkey Brain as a brand, and so asks our permission to be able to kind of co-brand those books to identify that they started life as digital titles through Monkey Brain. Which is why you see the Monkey Brain logo on those.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just IDW doing that as a nod to us rather than any kind of
there's no contractual
official
obligation.
Relationship yeah. between us.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
But it is mutually beneficial, too. It's like it builds your brand, but at the same time, your brand now is a recognizable one that people might spot and pick up the book then.
And really, like, you know, I've been talking to a number of different publishers recently, and it's funny because I'm like, oh, I guess we've become the farm team.
I'm glad you said that because I don't want it to make it sound – because it sounds like amateur or something like that. But
no, but that's exactly – I mean, but that's not really, you know, that's the kind of how that works, you know.
Yeah.
So, there's not really like – I don't know of a better kind of system that's been in place for last – years.
Not for a long time. You know, Image kind of was that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But now the Image has kind of shifted over to being the creator-owned haven for established professionals.
Right.
It doesn't seem, I mean, I know that they still publish things by newcomers, but it doesn't get as much attention as the stuff from the high-profile people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, they also probably don't generate the revenue that the...
Was print always part of your plan?
Yes, always. The whole idea was that we would do the digital first, you know, single issues, and that the creators would then be able to take those issues once there were enough of them and go to a print publisher and sell the trade collection.
There was a brief moment for about 5 minutes where we considered doing the print stuff ourselves.
And then I said no.
And we do our stuff.
And are you confident that that was the right choice your mental health?
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's there's always a possibility.
We do it. We have a book distributor. I mean, like, it's not like we don't have the ability or the channels or the wherewithal. But that would require a lot of financial capital to be put to invest in that kind of stuff. And you know, I would rather focus on other things.
And we, you know, we published several dozen books as Monkey Brain books over the course of the aughts. So we know how to do it. It's just a pain in the butt. Right.
So the elephant in the room, and I mentioned this before we started recording, is obviously the Amazon acquisition of Comixology. I'm curious about your perspective as a smaller publisher, the challenge of balancing that opportunity of a larger audience potentially with the obvious concerns of being lost in the shuffle.
Yep.
Yeah, all those things.
Is there any sort of outreach or communication that has gone out to those individuals, like Monkey Brain or other entities that might need to be represented in the conversation? Is there any?
Well, fortunately for us, you know, we have a really good relationship with the people that work at Comixology, and we've been kind of probably have been in the loop along with a lot of the other major publishers, ironically, mainly because we do give them what we do for Comixology and have done with the Eisner nominations and whatnot, and being a digital first publisher, you know. It's very much a positive thing, yeah. A beneficial relationship, I could say, between the two of us. And so we get some nice perks with that, which you know, some of that has been some communication. I think that it's still really early in the process. I think that, and this is complete speculation on my part, that, you know, we won't know the real ramifications of what that whole deal means for a while. Mm-hmm. I think that Comixology probably, you know, that's a whole culture that's going to be having to merge together. That is very different.
And I think that they're probably still trying to figure out how it's going to work.
Yes.
I don't think that Comixology or Amazon knows exactly what the road ahead is going to be. I think those conversations have just started.
Which makes sense because, you know, like I said, like that's two cultures coming together, you know, very different, you know, small entity compared to a very, very large multinational corporation. There's going to be, you know, it's going to take some time to integrate.
So it remains to be seen. I mean, we're optimistic, but we'll see.
Okay. I accept cautious optimism. That sounds
yeah, and the good news is that a lot of the, you know, the people that we've been dealing with are staying, you know, are staying in place, and so it's not like it's a whole new group of people. I think that their processes might end up being slightly different, but I haven't seen anything on a large scale besides the in-app purchases thing changing.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, you didn't hear about that? No. Did I forget to call you when that happened? Yeah. Besides, that was kind of a little bit of a surprise.
Was it? Okay.
Well, it was and it wasn't. It was a surprise when I got the phone call that it was going to happen the next day.
I was surprised when I got your text 2 minutes later.
Yeah. So, but I think that was kind of where everybody stood. So.
Okay. So Chris. Tell us what you're writing these days.
And I don't even know anymore.
What we can expect to see from you.
I don't know.
And in a minute, we also have to sing happy birthday to Dennis, so I hope everybody's ready for that.
What am I writing? I don't even know. Doc Savage was today. And see, well, the thing is, people want to know like what it is they can buy that I'm writing, whereas all I'm thinking is, what's my next deadline? I just turned into Doc Savage today, doing some more work on Aliens for the good people of Star Wars, which is part of their big, it's Prometheus Fire and Stone. Fire and Stone is the name of the thing, the event. They're not calling it an event, it's a thing.
Okay.
it's Prometheus, Predator versus Alien.
You're
and
really
Aliens.
Bad at this.
What? It's complicated.
You go to like a million meetings, you can't even talk about it.
I'm talking about it right now. You know, all those various Ridley Scott things in one overarching story. The writers are me, Paul Tobin, Joshua Williamson, and Chris Sabila.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Sabila. Artists include Patrick Reynolds, who's drawing Aliens with me, and other Dark Horse notables.
What else am I doing?
Yeah, that's quite the Portland power team.
Boy, it really is. And what's funny is they're all monkey brain people. Shh, don't tell anybody.
Sovereign's been coming out.
Yeah,
Sovereign, right, is a book I do with an artist named Paul Mayberry that started coming out from Image. Issue 2 came out last week, I think.
Yes, that's correct.
I do a book called Let Us and Rex with a guy named Dennis Culver, mm-hmm. which is the most I have any given month.
Happy birthday, Dennis.
Happy birthday, Dennis.
Happy birthday, Dennis.
Woo! The best collaborator kids could hope for. and he's always available to talk on Skype.
What else are you doing?
There's two things I can't talk about yet.
Two things you can't talk about. We should. You know what I want to talk about, though? I want to talk about how awesome the people are that are making iZombie TV show.
Okay, iZombie TV show.
Can I interject before that? Because I have a lot of fondness for that series, Living in Eugene. That was a very special series to me.
Well, now
it could be very special for people that live in other places.
That live maybe in Seattle. Yeah. I don't know.
I would be very surprised if the TV show had ended up in Eugene.
It's not.
That's all right. I still have the comic to keep me happy.
Sorry.
But anyway, I kind of want to talk about it because there's been a lot of like people that are like, oh, this isn't going to be anything like the comic, and it's not.
It's really not.
That would also have been surprising too, because it's very so stylized and kind of.
Well, actually, the closest similarity, the closest points of congruence between the pilot and the comic is the core idea and the tone of it, because like what they're trying to capture, rather than the plot and the details of the characters, is the tone of the comic, and they have actually made all the cast read the whole comic.
Yeah, everybody has read the book, like. All of it, like the all the cast members, all of the crew, the producers, like they love it, and they get the tone and the spirit of the comic is totally in the television show.
Well, that's good.
So while the plot will not be apples to apples, I really think that this is going to turn into a good show if it gets picked up, and I really hope it does for obvious reasons.
And they're shooting the pilot right now, right?
No, they've shot the pilot. They've turned everything in. It's done.
They turned it in today, right?
They turned it in yesterday.
Yesterday.
Wow. Do you get to see it?
Soon?
No, but we got to go visit.
We got to see two scenes over and over and over again from a variety of angles.
Uh-huh. And the people that are producing the show are, like, wonderful people. It just, like, it couldn't have been a better situation all around, honestly. So I kind of want people that are upset, you know, about the fact that it's not exactly like the comic, because I've seen a little bit of that online, you know, to kind of not be so upset. And definitely don't be upset for us. Oh, because sorry. Everybody wins if it gets picked up for series.
Because more people will discover the comic.
Right.
They have to give us money, which is awesome. And
I'm glad you're so candid about that.
What's that?
I'm glad you're so candid about that.
Getting money is awesome. And also means work for a lot of good people. So,
yeah.
Like, you know, so stop complaining, please.
I know the series is very special to you, Chris, but it, at the time, too, it seemed like that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, with its cancellation, with your relationship with DC.
Not really. I mean, I know that's what it seemed from the outside, because they followed closely chronologically.
Okay.
But in fact, iZombie was the thing that kept me from leaving DC earlier.
Okay.
Because I had already washed my hands of doing more work long before that. Mm. And, you know, I was continuing to work on iZombie. I didn't actually start complaining about the things I ended up complaining about. Because I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize the income of Mike and Laura Allred, who were my collaborators on the book.
Right.
And so basically, as soon as the book was wrapped up and I knew it was coming, then I felt more confident and comfortable kind of criticizing the editorial policies that I had took issue with.
I don't have a good way of posing this question, but it goes back to our social media discussion and that balance between promoting a brand and speaking up for, you know, what you believe in. And how do you both, because I think you both do this, I think you both speak your heart and what you feel very well, but how do you ride that line? Like how do you temper things when they need to be tempered and speak up when you feel that you can't be silent, if that makes sense?
Basically by just speaking up when we feel like we can't be silent. I mean, I think that we could probably get in the middle of a lot of different arguments or disagreements online with people, but that's not something that I think is constructive. Mm. You know,
it's kind of a question of picking the rattles, you know, because, you know, I do see there are people who, you know, who I have some degree of respect for, creators and others, who just seem to rail at stuff all the time, you know, or criticize stuff all the time. And if you shout at the same volume constantly about everything, you know, then you kind of get ignored pretty quick.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But also, like, they end up complaining about trivial crap. And so one of the things that I'm very conscious of now, once I realized a few years ago that people were actually listening to the nonsense I said online, is being fairly selective, you know. And if there's something, as Allison said, that we have to talk about, then by all means, I'll step up and talk about it.
Mm.
But it's much the same way that, like, once people I didn't know started paying attention to me in public, I really stopped talking about politics unless it was something that I thought was really important. You know, kind of minor political nonsense, you know, it doesn't raise the level of importance to me to talk about. But if there's something serious going on, like this legislation is going to take away women's rights, X, Y, and Z, then by all means, that's worth complaining about online.
And, you know, fundamentally, social media is, you know, a form of entertainment in some way. And I think that, like, if you're not slightly entertaining or try to be entertaining or,
mm-hmm.
you know,
that if you're you have to push a cause, but you have to be engaging in it as well.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I kind of don't, you know, I don't,
you can't
really
just be strident and shrill all the time.
Well, you know, that, and then also just not constantly promoting yourself, you know.
Oh, God,
like, I think that, like, you know, there's a certain responsibility that people should take with social media, that I think a lot, for the most part, people do, but some people don't. You know, it's
short and funny wins the race.
Yeah.
Well,
and then people won't mind when you talk about, like, your thing that you wrote or your thing you're selling or whatever. And
Chris,
maybe people want to support it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chris, do you feel like there's a, and I guess I'm singling you out specifically because you write for other publishers, but yet you are a publisher. Is there a pool there where you are sort of servant of two masters when you're speaking up publicly, or at this point, is it just, it's Chris Robertson, so you get to say whatever you want?
You know, I think it depends. Like certainly, you know, I think it's true of any freelance writer or artist in comics, you know, has to be aware of the kinds of criticisms that they'll voice online. You know, because everybody is a potential employer coming.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's kind of this perception that, you know, people shouldn't criticize, you know, creators shouldn't criticize other creators or their work or say something sucks. And yeah, I'm certainly kind of conscious of that, you know. But again, it's just a question of choosing battles. Like, if there's something that I think is egregious enough, or like that impinges upon me directly, or at least in somebody I know, there's a couple of things that go on that are kind of behind closed doors, and I don't have enough information to speak about publicly. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. certain kind of like creator rights kinds of issues that I'm reasonably sure skeevy stuff's going on, but I don't know enough.
Right.
So it's irresponsible of me to kind of raise that flag. You know, off the record and in bars, I'll tell people I would be careful about that outfit, because I think maybe there's some questionable stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not something that I'm an authority on. So
Yeah.
Well, Allison, can I ask you then, there's a lot of conversations happening within the industry, you know, kind of about changing comics for the better. And so now being this small publisher of these selective, you know, high quality books, like what are a few of those top things you wish could be changed immediately in the industry? And would that help you get more comics in front of more readers? What would you change to better comics right now?
I think that there needs to be a real concerted effort for comics that children can read.
Hmm.
And not necessarily, you know, not necessarily children's comics, but comics that children would be interested in and want to read on a mass scale.
And maybe even aimed at adults that kids could also read.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, there's tons of, I could talk about that forever.
And it's okay, we talk about that all the time. So
yeah, and it's not really, and I don't know that it's, that me in the position of a monkey brain publisher is the person that can do that. You know, I think that's a responsibility as a comics professional that we all should be working towards.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think without that, we are really short-sighted about the future of this market.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But as a comics publisher, is it something you can focus on promoting?
Well, I can do what I can do, but unfortunately, I think, you know, us as small as we are, you know, can only do so much.
Uh-huh.
You know, we do have all ages titles that we publish, mm-hmm. and they've been some of the more popular books that we do. And it's really nice to see kids getting excited about Amelia Cole or Edison Rex or Captain Ultimate
or Bandette
or Bandette. You know, but it's such a small piece. I think on a larger scale, it would be, I think there's ways to do that on a larger scale, you know, with characters people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But for the generation that's coming up, for the kid, the way that my kid, you know, experiences media, books, what she's interested in, you know, I think that children have a very different experience today than we did growing up.
Right.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, it's good and bad at the same time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's far more accessibility than there was to us, but also, I guess, the influence, like the desire and the promotion is not focused to them.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I mean, but a lot of what's filling that void, you know, for, you know, as far as comics go or books or whatever is manga.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's what I see happening. It's like, you know, and so that market's filling that void. And the US market's like, doesn't even know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't even thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense because that definitely seems to be, I can think of now a bunch of examples of friends who have children, you know, young teens who are, you know, so involved in that. Because it seems to appeal to them greatly.
You know, our daughter's in the fourth grade, and I think every kid in her class probably has at least read some, whether it's Pokemon or...
I mean, Pokemon is the...
Naruto or
is
whatever.
Is the gateway drug.
Yeah. And so, like, our daughter started reading Pokemon stuff, and it was okay. I mean, you know, I would check it out and be like, yeah, it's decent. And then she was kind of like looking for something to read. And I'm like, I went to the shelf and pulled down the first volume of Rumiko Takahashi's Ranma ½.
Hmm.
And so now she's read like 36 volumes of Ranma ½. And it started in Ayasha or whatever. But anyway, then she's taking it to her school and she's distributing it to her friends. Like, here, read Ranma if your parents are okay with occasional nudity.
You know who's doing? You know who's actually doing something interesting? IDW has these little packs that they are making, and they've started with My Little Pony, and they've basically shrunk down the comics and relettered them because they've shrunk them down, obviously, so you can read them. Of My Little Pony comics, but it comes in this plastic thing and is sold like at the cash register, basically.
Like trading cards would be.
Like trading cards or whatever. Hmm. And it comes with a tattoo and a sticker.
Yeah.
And I think there's some, is there activities in the back of it?
Maybe.
A little bit?
Oh, wow.
And, man, are those things popular with my daughter and her friends.
Wow.
And it was like, because Ted sent me a bunch of them.
Ted Adams.
Because we were at Emerald City, and we were talking about My Little Pony, and he's like, oh, I'll send you a bunch of stuff. So he sent me a bunch of the stuff that they're doing, and he sent me a box of those packs.
Because he wanted basically to use Georgia.
He wanted feedback. And so she started being like the dealer, you know, like you know, this one wants a comic and this one wants a sticker and like.
Well, she's savvy too, because at first she just took a fistful of the packs and handed those out. And then when they all opened them and they wanted different stickers and stuff, then she busted all of them out, sorted through them, triaged it, and is like supplying them. Oh, this person wants the Twilight Sparkle sticker. And so-and-so wants the Rainbow Dash tattoo.
That's amazing.
That's something that, like, it's completely outside the direct market.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely in a mass media sense. You know, in Walmart, in Target.
Now, granted, it might not be the real thing.
Okay, don't.
All right.
But like that's somebody like that's thought about something outside the box and how do we you know, because the problem is that there's nowhere to shelve floppy comics except in the magazine section.
But nobody goes.
And nobody goes to the magazine section.
Right. No, I never see a kid in the book section of Target.
So you have to figure out where are the kids going in those stores. And they'll be at the toy aisle and they'll be at the checkout.
Or by the trading cards.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's smart.
Here's my question about that in sort of the reverse approach, because you guys have a daughter and I have a son. Aaron has two boys. Clearly, amongst the four of us, there's no question that we see the importance of encouraging young readers, that we talk about all ages stories all the time. It totally blows my mind that this is a hard sell. But what can readers, not publishers and not creators, but just average fans, what can readers do to support the new creation of more all ages titles? I think that a lot of people don't know how to communicate that to those in the position to make those decisions.
Well, so one thing that could be done, relatively simple, would be that if there's good stuff that they're aware of, right? Every kid, everybody, if someone knows kids, if they have kids, if they're in their families, there's birthdays and Christmases and other holidays that roll around. Buy those kids some good comics, man, because lots of kids don't have comic, you know, they don't have books in their house in many cases.
Right.
Because, you know, sales are certainly going to be a factor. Like, the better books perform, you know, my kid's school is, you know, the library is pretty small, but it's really well stocked with graphic novels and comics in the school library. But, you know, donating comics to school.
Because you live in Portland.
We do live in Portland. It's an arts-focused elementary school in Portland. So it is exactly what you think it is.
Utopia.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I mean, those are the two easiest things. It's just because the more people are aware of stuff, maybe they'd pick up more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I run into some frustration because I feel like we all keep having the same conversation. And like what Allison said about larger publishing companies, characters that are so recognizable and yet there's no access to them for younger readers.
Like, well, I had like this whole idea of like how you integrate all that together, you know, like you integrate animation along with the comic, along with the toys, all at the same time, instead of having it be completely separate from one another.
Right. Yeah. I would love that. Let's do it. I don't think I get to make that decision though, unfortunately.
When I'm in charge of the universe, you know, you never know. Someday.
I want more of Lauren Faust's Super Best Friends. And I want it everywhere.
We'll write that down. We're going to send that out as a press release to everyone.
Okay.
And
if you don't know what Lauren Faust's Super Best Friends is, do you guys know that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know where I picked it up. Maybe, I mean, somewhere online. obviously.
Yeah, but they, you know, there the DC Nation interstitial shorts that would air with Young Justice or the Batman Brave and the Bold, and now the only place it survives anymore is on Teen Titans Go, are these little minute-and-a-half-long shorts. And so Lauren Faust, best known now for reinvigorating My Little Pony with My Little Friendship is Magic.
I think it was IO9 picked them up and was posting them separately.
Yeah. Well, now they're all online. They're all on. There's a DC Nation YouTube channel. Right. And there's DC Nation. Is there an app? There's a site? Mm-hmm. I don't know. They're all fantastic. And unfortunately, like, they did a similar kind of product line available through Target, but they didn't use those designs and they made everybody pink. It's just stupid.
Is that part of it
that the all ages kind of portions, especially the big publishers, is sort of I would say marginalized and not very cohesive even within the publishers themselves?
Yes.
Okay. I guess it's an obvious question with an obvious answer, but I don't
know. Because the comic companies that we have, the big established ones, have evolved alongside the market that they helped create. So the direct market is the way it is because of what companies were in existence and successful when the direct market started.
Mm-hmm.
But the existence of the direct market has kind of forced the evolution of those companies in kind of different ways as well. So the loss of the newsstand and the kind of general reader audience meant that those publishers started more and more just selling to the people that buy things in the direct market.
Right.
And they've forgotten how to sell things to other kinds of people, by and large.
And it's also when you're talking about these big, gigantic companies owned by bigger, gigantic companies, it's a matter of how can you justify losing money on an investment in the future? I think there's that short that's kind of lost, you know.
I think it's actually a lot simpler than that. There's a lot of bureaucracy across all of the different departments, and to navigate all of them and unify them is very, very difficult. Mm. You know,
maybe the salvation lies in small publishing then.
I don't know. I think, you know, those are cultural icons, those characters.
Yeah. True. Yeah.
And you know, I think lots of people got the impression, based on me being a loudmouth, that I was somehow against work for hire, or I was against, you know, corporate comics or whatever, which was never the case. And, you know, I think that those things are part of our shared cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like nothing more than to be able to hand my kid and any kid that I know good comics and books featuring those characters I grew up loving. That would be fantastic.
Absolutely. Hmm. Sign me up.
Me too.
Okay, I have one more question for you, and it has nothing to do with comics.
That's all we know.
No, you know this too. I promise you. You definitely know this topic.
Okay.
Cocktails. What is your favorite drink to enjoy now that it's warming up and porch drinking is a thing again?
My go-to is always the Caipirinha.
Is it run a lime shortage?
Oh my God. Freaking drug lords. Do you guys know about the lime shortage?
I do, because Avi's class read a Time for Kids article about it. So he came home and told me the reason why I couldn't buy limes the other day was because of the lime shortage.
Yep, it's crazy. I think fancy drunks like myself, and by that I mean people that get drunk on fancy drinks, were probably the first to notice. But I was horrified a while back.
I was wondering why there are so many people kind of stumbling around yelling incoherently in the streets. It's because there's so much outrage against shortage of limes.
They're stumbling coherently and yelling
right.
Without slurring.
That's right. Something's wrong here. These people make sense.
Much more prone to scurvy. For anybody that doesn't know, a bacterial blight hit the plantations in Mexico and wiped out a huge percentage of the lime yield, which drove the price of limes up fractionally, well, considerably. Because limes were then a more valuable commodity, the local drug lords took over the roads and exacted punitive tolls from the farmers to deliver their crops to market.
I don't think that was in the Time for Kids article.
They probably got a simpler version of the story. Huh. So yeah, Mexican, a blight plus Mexican drug lord and Mexican cartels has tripled the price of limes in most American states. They went.
So what are you doing, Chris? Like, what's your alternative?
So I've been trying to drink as slowly as possible. No, I've been comparison shopping around town. The Safeway, I don't want to give up my source. There is a store that has cheaper limes.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how, but they're 20 cents cheaper a piece.
Because they come from Guam.
I don't know what it is.
So what's in your drink?
Is the Caipirinha, but the caveat being that I have introduced the shaker into my recipe in the last few months.
Oh.
And I think that it is much improved.
Yeah, it has. I'm a fan of the Pimm's Cup.
Ooh, that's a good one too.
Nice choice.
For warmer weather.
Also with citrus, though.
Just lemon, though.
Yeah, but lemon parts.
But it's a slice.
Yeah.
A lemon.
Lemons, as far as I'm aware, lemons were not affected.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were at a bar the other night, and I got the slimmest slice of lemon lime wedge I've ever seen.
Slice. I was like, wow.
It was literally, it was a thick piece of cardboard.
it was bad.
Yeah. Did you have to talk to them about the lime shortage, or did you just accept that?
Yeah.
They knew. Yeah.
They knew it?
Yeah.
It's all anybody's talking about in Portland.
At my house,
It is a hot topic.
Uh-huh. Well, I think we've exhausted all our questions for one day. We need to go back and make some mixed drinks and relax now.
Yeah.
Thanks.
It's 5 o'clock. It's quitting time.
That's true. So thanks again, both of you, for sitting on the couch with us this week. Thanks to everyone else for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, on comicstherapy.com. We'll talk to you next week.